Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Dr. Tanveer Ahmed, a Sydney-based psychiatrist, author, and newspaper columnist. His books include Fragile Nation and In Defence of Shame. He's written regularly for the Australian Financial Review, The Australian, and for the Sydney Morning Herald, amongst other publications. He served on local government and on multiple boards and advisory committees. Today we discuss the recent controversy regarding the Bankstown Hospital nurses and anti-Semitism in Australia more generally, how seriously we should take those remarks, and how they are similar and different to other forms of sectarianism that has existed in Australia, whether identity politics is really such a bad thing, and some broader discussion about nationhood, liberalism, and identity, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Tanveer Ahmed, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Oh, Dan, great to be with you. Yeah, you've already created some headlines, the occasional headlines, so it's wonderful to be part of.
Great stuff. Well, I really should say welcome back because we did do a podcast early days, but I was still learning the ropes and unfortunately deleted it. So that one will be lost to posterity or somewhere in the internet, the cloud. Hey, you have been at a part of Sydney which has created some news. You wrote an article in the Daily Telegraph, I think, about goings-on at the Bankstown Hospital. For those maybe international listeners, what has been generating those headlines? What's the cause of it?
I mean, we all know there's been, you know, however long, almost 18 months since the October 7 attacks in Israel. So that's caused heated debate about that Israel-Palestine issue all over the world, and not least in Australia, and caused a lot of social strain, especially in diverse multicultural communities. Now, as part of that, I guess there's been a surge of anti-Semitism, including attacks on synagogues. And to be honest, the actual perpetrators haven't been found to be Muslim in any of the cases. Yeah, at least the majority anyway that I've seen.
That's right. The actual alleged terrorist attacks and all the rest of it, that's still under investigation. But two nurses at the Bankstown Hospital.
The incident that happened. I mean, early in the piece, we remember the protest in the Opera House, which generated headlines right across the world, and there was sort of debate what they were saying regarding the Jews. Was it F the Jews? Was it various? But I guess a follow-on from that, so very recently there was a case where an Israeli social media influencer was interviewing people. It happened to be two nurses who were in their health outfits, health uniforms, if you like. It's in New South Wales Health, which state we live in. And while they were talking to this guy, they basically openly said that if they treated a Jewish patient, they would kill them. I mean, they said kill them in a kind of performative, symbolic way. They said they would send them to Jahannam, which is the Arabic word for hell. So they effectively openly bragged about this. But I guess unbeknownst to them, they were recorded and then it was leaked and it became global headlines, in fact. But it certainly created a big stir here. And I guess for me, it sort of raised things. A lot of the anti-Semitism at a cultural level, I think, is primarily in the Islamic community and in the global Islamic community. That's not its historical origins, but I think this incident really highlighted the depth of that when two pillars of the community, like these are, one of them was an award-winning nurse, and so they would have been, these are high-status, highly regarded people in their community, and when they're openly stating such things such in such a brazen way, that to me is a real sign that, you know, there's something quite deep. And that is my own experience, and that's really what I wrote about, that
you wrote well about it. Do you think this the statements they made, do you think that sort of casual talk about casual anti-Semitic talk, is that new? Or is that something that is only now
being public because of social media, where all our lives are public. I mean, clearly the Opera House and the attacks on synagogues, that is an uptick in anti-Semitic violence. But the actual way those nurses were talking, do you think that is reflective of parts of the Islamic community, including
Look, I think so. If you remember, and look, no, I'm not remotely comparing the nurses to Hamas, but after Hamas attacks, you know, you had kids, you had like teenage kids who were bragging to their parents that, you know, I killed Jews in absolute pride. Now, that's an extreme. But if we go back from there, I think it is the sort of comment in terms of what you might do to a Jewish person, et cetera. I think it's probably said in a locker room type way, but that is the sort of thing you may hear, you know, at a dinner party or between, you know, could be friends at the equivalent of a pub, you know, could be in a mosque, talking in a mosque or whatever it might be. So you are right that the internet and social media are better at pricking or exposing things that have kind of lay in the background, you know, always or for a long time. And it kind of exposes them. And I guess we respond in shock, mainly because it's suddenly public.
Yeah. When I saw those nurses, it's a sectarianism that of in the Islamic community against the Jewish community. There has been an older type of sectarianism, and with my Irish background, it sort of got me thinking. You know,
there's a small chance.
I was just saying that scene made me think of, you know, Irish forebears sectarianism in Australia. And I can kind of guarantee that you would have been able to find old relations of mine saying, "Fuck the Brits, you know, free the provinces of Ulster, and you know, let's go and, you know, beat them up," that type of thing.
I think you're right. I think that was a bit of bravado, but I think in the climate that it was spoken in, you know, took an elevated significance. But I agree with you. I think it's highly unlikely. I've certainly never seen it in my work. But maybe there was an added dimension here. You know, we've had various people talk about healthcare is such a critical part, a bit like the NHS in the UK was such a critical part of our egalitarian identity. And for something like this to come out in, you know, healthcare professionals sort of struck at something beyond just, say, the Israel-Palestine stuff. It struck at something wider as well. So I think there was a combination of things in this particular incident that magnified it.
Yeah, I even think, though, you know, during the troubles in Northern Ireland, which would have excited people in Australia, medical professions of Irish descent might have, you know, got a bit radicalized over, but they still would have treated all patients that came in the same way, right?
I think that's secret. You know, you say that all the time where, you know, Israelis would regularly treat Palestinians and you know, you see it in the war zones, you know, where you're treating enemy combatants sometimes. So I think that's where it just struck at something, a bit of a sacred duty of the healthcare worker. Mm. And I think people found that especially shocking. I mean, I think it's highly unlikely that I've never seen that on display in any form where somebody, a health worker, was displaying some sort of favoritism in a especially inappropriate way.
I mean, they did claim to have killed patients, which, I mean,
that's sure. I mean, look, you can't dismiss it. So, you know, I mean, I guess the authorities would have to do some sort of examination, but I think it's extremely unlikely. You know, I think it's a bit of bravado. They're on night shift. It's the middle of the night. I mean, these two they're both in their mid-20s, I think.
Do you know them?
No, but I know. I guess I have co-workers who certainly know them. That one of them, the male one, looked familiar to me, so I probably walked past him. So, we certainly liaise with their department regularly.
It also got me thinking, and this may, you may or may not remember this, but when Obama was running for office, he had his famous Reverend Wright. And footage was released of him claiming that, all sorts of things, that the chickens were coming home to roost for America because of, and 9/11 was their own fault, and the age was deliberately spread in the black community. This was before really social media. I think it was online, but I'm not sure whether it was, I think it was a bit pre-Twitter at least, or X.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's, and Peggy Noonan, the columnist for the Wall Street Journal at the time, said that she made this connection similarly to Irish sectarianism, that it didn't really get her Irish up. That's sort of like bravado and talk within particular ethnic communities.
It shouldn't be
necessarily assumed to be, you know, a call for violence amongst them. There are disputes going on. There were, you know, IRA dropping bombs, and there are, you know, Palestinians, you know, and committing atrocities and all the rest of it. But the likelihood that that group, with their sort of tough guy talk, would actually do anything shouldn't necessarily be.
Look, I agree with you. I totally agree with you, in fact. And you know, remember, you've got a hyper-masculine culture. You've got this sort of Lebanese culture too, which is hyper-masculine. You know, it's all about these kind of displays of machismo and bravado, which can inflect flow through to the women sometimes too. So it's a combination of all that. And there's a street kind of hip-hop culture too. You know, they sort of almost combine.
Yeah.
You know, hey, I'm going to do this to them, et cetera.
Plus, so TikTok, absolutely. Viral and all the rest of it, you've got to be promoting.
Yeah, that's right. So I do agree with you, but I guess in the particular climate just took on an extra dimension. But I guess, look, one of the key points I wanted to make in what I wrote is, I mean, you're certainly exposed to it growing up. When you speak to your family and relatives, they talk about it not being, I'm talking about anti-Semitism here, and I guess Islamic religious observance too, when they were much younger, say in the 60s, 70s, it wasn't terribly on show. Like, I'm talking South Asia, but it's a trend right across the world, where some of these things are relatively modern, and they've occurred in parallel with what we might call Islamism, where you've had a set of ideas around, I guess, Islamic humiliation, Western domination, kind of a reversion to some sort of traditional practices, but within a very modern sphere, outward symbols of identity, all of these sort of trends. And as part of that, there's been a type of anti-Semitism that is quite different to, historically, Muslims and Jews probably got on better than Christians and Jews in large swaths of history and throughout the Middle East and North Africa. I mean, it's certainly not universal, and most of the time they were still a dominated population, but you know, Muslims tolerated them well while they were paying extra taxes and what have you. But they did have a special place. You know, they were called people of the book. There was a pretty there was a bit of a reverence given they were given the two books, two religions were so close on so many arenas. But I guess what I'm alluding to is that modern anti-Semitism is primarily Islamic, but not only is it Islamic, it's derived from European varieties. The tropes are often Christian, Western European. There are even strands of sort of Soviet anti-Semitism, and they sort of got beamed out to the Arab world throughout World War II in particular. Interesting, I didn't know when I was researching this article, I didn't realize the Nazis had an Arabic channel. And in fact, so National Socialism was in fact quite influential with Arab socialism, with a lot of the Arab nationalism that really took off post-World War II. The Nazis were in fact quite influential in some of those regimes, at least philosophically. So you just have this funny mix of this nexus of Jews, Israel, Palestinians as a symbol of Muslims being dominated and held back by Western domination, and a sense that Muslims needed to rise up, and Jews were part of this domination, both historical and especially current, through this symbol of Israel. And I think that's where the anti-Semitism has a very modern flavor, and it has strong ties with the growth of Islamism. I think that's what's especially interesting about the modern expressions of anti-Semitism. And you're seeing these trends around the world where, as you're getting bigger local Islamic communities within Western countries, especially in Western Europe, but also other parts of the world, including Australia, that is a major factor in where anti-Semitic trends, including violence, is rising. And you're getting quite big migrations of Jewish people, often to, sometimes to Israel, sometimes to America, wherever it might be. So while there are other anti-Semites in, say, these groups, anti-Semites, white supremacists, to some extent, left more generally. While that would be couched very much in anti-Israel, but it sees modern the Jewish communities as oppressors, that they're now sort of rich and powerful, and they're supported by the United States, and this makes them part of the enemy.
Yeah, I kind of obviously sympathetic to the tragedy and the uptick in ethnic violence in Australia. I find it that a little bit of the mainstream response in the opinion pages, not yours, of course, but a little bit underwhelming because, for example, there seems to be blame sheeted home to the universities as though it's an ideological cause of this, and I don't really know what that holds true. Like, you're trying to tell me that sympathy for the Palestinian cause in the western suburbs of Sydney is the result of them attending a sociology lecture by Palestinian political science lecture. It's not ideological. There's an ethnic component, and I feel like people want to, David Kemp and that thing talked about identity politics and being coming out of the universities and spreading amongst the population at large. I don't know. I just don't think ultimately that is the real cause, right? It's old style.
Certainly not the cause, but I think where universities are significant here is they become a primary site where the broader left fuses with, say, Palestinian liberation activists, right? So the site of the university is a key area where you could be an Islamist, you could be a Palestinian activist, and meanwhile you're also a transgender activist, you're a socialist, you're part of the Socialist Party, the so-called unholy alliance, so to speak. And then I think when all the fever, anti-Israel fever, is whipped up and they can't necessarily project healthily onto the Israeli government, it's too far away, and the risk then that it flows through to the ordinary Jew, including the one that's visibly Jewish on campus. So I think that's, and look, some of this happened with Muslims, of course, particularly at the height of in the first sort of decade after September 11 in particular. It was most pronounced. So that's probably where the universities are most are significant. I certainly don't think they're the origins. Absolutely. Certainly not the, I think they contribute. I mean, some of the intellectual ballast is coming in terms of Israel as the oppressor and a lot of the leftist ideas and how anti-Semitism should be seen. There's still lots of intellectual ballast that comes from the universities, but
people down at the Opera House, they weren't Chinese predominantly. I mean, there might have been an odd one, or they weren't Italians, or Greeks, right? And were any kind of people flooding out of the university lectures and heading down to the Opera House? I don't think that's really.
No, I agree, but I think that's one arm of it, and you are. I think that's a specific arm that is directly from the Muslim community, and they're really just going on a straight out rage, pro-Palestine, pro-Muslim ummah. I think that group is almost an extension of Islamism aimed at Israel and the Jewish community. The leaders of that group have probably been on university campuses.
It's possible. I just think there's a tendency amongst the kind of opinion writing class to turn things into ideological arguments when really there's a sort of intractable ethnic component to them. And the English speaking world, with the exception of Northern Ireland, doesn't really, at least until recent times, doesn't really have that much exposure to intractable ethnic conflict, right? And it always thinks you can solve these problems without, you know, a better social problem and a tax rate adjustment or this, that, and stuff. And some problems, you know, you solve them ultimately, like is the case with the sort of much milder, I think, sectarianism in Australia between the Catholics and the, through intermarriage and fighting in wars together and burying your parents in Australia and all the rest of it. And that used to be, you know, it's harder, I think, in Australia today, given the sheer numbers of people to sort of mold that cohesive identity, right? You, I think in the last article you wrote for the Fin Review, you still think you're in favor of a very solid immigration program. I think you're right. Despite the visible anti-migration sentiment across the Western world, opposition leader Peter Dutton's policy of drastic reduction in Australia's migration intake is both unprecedented in recent times and economically unrealistic. Do you still think that's the case? And if so, what should the numbers be?
Look, I don't think I'd have a set number, but I think a place like Australia with the, much of the Western world, you've got these, you know, huge aging populations, huge gaps in the economy. I think it's very hard for us. And the reality is I think the middle class are pretty used to cheap goods, cheap services, and a lot of that is driven by migration. You know, it's by whether we're outsourcing production to foreigners or we're bringing in foreigners who in their first 5 or 10 years are often doing pretty low-paid work. I think in that same column I talked about, you know, the key problem with immigration, it's there's people who use immigrants in capital, if you like, through capital driven, basically they use immigrants to make their businesses better, or make their products better. And then there's large swathes of the population that compete with immigrants. And I think this is really what's happened in America, where you've got huge chunks coming over the border and they end up suppressing wages of a lot of lower wage workers. Whereas a lot of people in the upper echelons, they end up with cheaper goods and services. Now that's a simplistic way to look at it, but the benefits do not accrue equally. I guess the point is in terms of migration. And I think that's the part we need to focus on better. How do we redistribute the benefits of migration to the groups that aren't necessarily receiving them? I think that would be a more sophisticated argument. Now, look, obviously there's a cultural component too. Like you've let in too many migrants that, especially quite distinct from the dominant culture, that has other risks as well, you know, has cultural risks. So I think that's what a lot of this blowback is, you know, building up over several decades.
Because so I agree. Yeah, I mean, with all these conflicts going around the world and what have, you know, and intellectual drivers and this, that, and the other, the reality is we wouldn't be seeing them on our streets if we didn't have, you know, large-scale communities that of different ethnicities that sometimes are antagonistic towards each other, right? Create that reality. And so I sort of feel like, can't we have, like, much, like, a pause for a while or a much lower immigration so we can let the magic of Australia do its thing and mold a new, you know, mold them all into a new Australian identity or make that the dominant identity that they have.
Let's go back to the Opera House protests. I guess some people would say a dominant group there may have been a group that we didn't we weren't quite as sophisticated in terms of choosing our migrants. So it was a lower skilled variety, predominantly Lebanese. And they integrated differently. They have higher rates of disability, welfare dependence, unemployment, crime, you name it. So arguably that group out of the Opera House was probably one of the few groups of migrants that haven't integrated terribly well.
Do you think there would be any Bangladeshis down there or not?
Probably unlikely. I think that was that particular group, I think, would have been predominantly Middle Eastern, would have been Lebanese, Syrian, et cetera. That, I think that's my impression of that particular group. Now, lots of other pro-Palestine protests would absolutely be much more mixed. It'd be a combination of all sorts of Muslim groups, South Asians, a lot of ethnic groups, a lot of people just who identify with the left, a lot of university students, so all sorts of groups. I think it'd be a broad representation of the left in general. Mm. But I think, you know, without knowing the individual figures of the Opera House protest, I think that one was more specifically ethnic. That's just my inkling. It's my inkling. Mm. Without, you know, I don't know that for sure.
One of the lines that you see in the center-right opinion pages is that, oh, we need to crack down on identity politics. Identity politics is the bogeyman. And I always, again, you know, just pause on that, because identity is quite a good thing, right? And people will naturally want an identity. And so there'll always be some identity that needs to be created, and simply about which one prevails. I mean, is identity, don't people need an identity that psychologically and otherwise to sort of be healthy? And
I guess, you know, the argument would be, we absolutely need identity, but that the argument would be, if we're pushing, say, you know, our ethnic identity is important, we have multiple multiplicity of identities, I guess. Mm-hmm. We're trying to build diverse multicultural societies of citizens, of individual citizens. And if you're unable to, that as an individual citizen, if you're not able to build, I guess, a strong sense of saying what an Australian citizen is and what an Australian is, and if that is something that is suppressed or it's communicated as something a bit shameful, I guess this is what the key conservative argument would be. Then these more, what might be called, I would call them primitive identities, but the more unchangeable, be it biology or ethnic, you may latch onto that as your primary identity. And then you split into tribes. So building a nation, I mean, a nation is a very artificial, you know, a very artificial concept and a relatively modern one. For most of history, we did exist in tribes and even, you know. So now we're trying to build diverse multicultural nations. If you don't have a relatively strong national identity, then there'll be other identities that potentially dominate, sometimes dangerously so.
But you have Bangladeshi heritage. I think you were born in Bangladesh, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
That has a modern nationalist story, a heroic one, where, you know, broke free from Pakistan. And it's always, the impression I have of the Bangladeshis is always, you know, very literate, Vikram Seth.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Ramendra Tagore. And, you know,
Bengal, the region, has been called the France of South Asia.
That's right.
A little bit different to France. But economically declined, yeah.
And I get the impression that it was it's more linguistic. Islam too, but, you know, Islam exists in Pakistan, but so why split them? It was much to do with a separate identity which was more important than even than the religion itself, or at least distinctive from what the type of Islam that existed in Pakistan, right?
Well, you are right. So Bangladesh really came out about from a linguistic nationalism, and that is kind of the organizing principle of the country. But because of where it is, from Indian partition, it's a tension between this secular linguistic nationalism and a more Islamic or Islamist type scenario, which Pakistan is. So it is almost a mix of India and Pakistan. Those sort of tensions play out in the country.
Do you see when you talk about Islamists, do you see more burqas on the streets of Dhaka than maybe you did 20 years ago?
Absolutely. And you'd certainly see plenty now, because the most recent government that was effectively brought down by individual citizenry, in fact, particularly university students. So if there's one place in the world recently where university students exerted, you know, something quite consequential power. It was in Bangladesh in, you know, last year through these protests, because it was sort of self-organized and they really took on a government that had become dictatorial. And that government did represent linguistic nationalism. The father of the prime minister was sort of known as the father of the nation. They had strong ties to India. So having been overthrown, the opposing forces, which are more Islamic and religious and less focused on the linguistic nationalism, have risen to an extent. Now, whether they actually gain a formal power or not is another thing. But absolutely, that more outward religiosity, it is much more pronounced. And that's a sort of tension that you get throughout the Islamic world. You get traditional identities, non-religious identities competing for a more pan-Islamic type of forces. And they try and intermingle. And sometimes they coexist in a good mix. But sometimes one attempts to dominate, or particularly the Islamic one ends up dominating a more traditional or historically, a more local historical identity is almost quashed by a pan-Islamic one.
Yeah. It seems to me, you know, we celebrate these nationalist movements. Well, not celebrate, but we recognize there's a certain heroic kind of struggle in them and establishing themselves in Bangladesh and other parts of the world. The Irish nationalism, they have a state, you know, Italians and all the rest of it back in the late 19th century. And yet New World countries like Australia, Canada, United States, we are expected to be these just civic national countries where we're a bundle of liberal rights and people can come from wherever. And the most important thing about us is that we accommodate whatever you want to do, whatever religion you want to be. And so we're different, at least that is the argument people make. We're different from the Argentinians or the Italians or the Germans. Like, you know, a Frenchman isn't an Italian simply because they both believe in freedom of speech. And Mussolini was Italian, even though he was the, you know, radical Marxist. They're all Italian. It's not ideology as such which makes them part of the nation. And yet in Australia, in the United States, we don't talk like that. We talk like that's not Australian values. We need to, you know, we need to be even sort of preferencing a particular language or religion or a way of life is seen as illegitimate because the key thing for these New World nations supposedly is their neutrality towards any culture. Is there kind of a problem with that long term? Don't people need to be us in Australia and elsewhere be part of the nation in the same way that Bangladeshis or Italians or others, struggled to establish their own nations?
Well, I think that's what you're saying with the rise of, I guess sometimes what are called, you know, the Trumpian movement, if you like, is linked to that countries like ours do have a deep identity, have a cultural and ethnic identity, and it's something not to be ashamed of, and it's something that potentially others can be pulled into, and we don't necessarily have to suppress it. So I think an interesting insight is because you think partly of the idea of multiculturalism, and we celebrate sort of any foreign culture kind of displaying their symbols, their, Ramadan's coming up, for example. You know, we kind of celebrate any ethnic group showing off their rituals and their culture, which is great. I mean, I'm all for that. But if this anything that's, Australia Day is a great example. You know, if you're showing off flags and you're going on about our British roots or Australian culture, then you could easily be accused of being a racist or something along those lines, you know, being a bit too militantly proud of Australia could easily be criticized. So what's happened in the Western world, particularly the non-American world, is sometimes that more ethnic or cultural nationalism, it channeled through things like free speech. It channeled through an ideological lens because it can't be displayed outright in a more ethnic or cultural variety. So I think it's one way it's been challenged. It's been channeled. When you've had these, especially say back in when Trump first won, and you've seen it in other movements throughout Europe, you know, it was all about the white supremacists. You know, they're obsessed with free speech, and rightly so. I mean, it's very important, but it was almost it was an unusual expression of it. That the way it was fought for was almost in like ethno-cultural terms, if you like.
Yeah, but should it, when you say, I mean, there's a hard ethno-culturalism and there's a sort of more reasonable sort, right? I feel, criticize me and all the rest of it, but and the hate speech laws, but, you know, France has a particular history and culture and religion and look to it, right? It's not simply and it's different from the Germans. And so can't the French as a sort of, which can incorporate, you know, it can mold on slowly different groups of people to form part of it. But it's not simply a matter of like someone coming and signing on a dotted line that I agree with a particular value statement, right? It's not like joining a corporation. It's much more kind of multi-generational kind of commitment, which will effectively, by the time you're truly part of a nation, you may have actually lost a large part of your identity to the old one. There's a passage in the Old Testament from the Book of Ruth where it talks about, you know, my people shall be your people, and and someone's leaving their old identity behind, and in that case, becoming part of the Jewish nation, right? And isn't that, you know, that's sort of what, you know, that's what drives people. That's what drives someone to a large part of what the drive for the Palestinians is. They want their own state. The Jewish people want their state. They're not fighting in a sense for abstract. They may couch it in those terms, like where the, you know, liberal state and all the rest of it. Ultimately, it's their ethnic identity which is driving. I don't know. I just feel like sometimes that what's lacking in the West is that we lack that. Like some of the you know, disaffected, you know, people in, you know, poorer counties, they're not permitted to have that national identity in the way that some of the other groups that are part of other nations are. Do you think that's valid, or do you think it's just not possible to, whenever you permit that argument to intrude, you risk, you know,
the challenge is still we're trying to build these civic sort of nations. You know, most of I mean, one of the interesting insights, and this is sort of Fukuyama talking about how there was a difference with America and Europe, is fundamentally America's prime identity is a civic one, right? Where and that allows the whereas even France, even all of much of Western Europe, and even Britain, their fundamental identities are ethno-cultural. So any second or third, say a second or third generation Turk in Germany, it's much harder for them to be German than it is for a second or third generation Korean in America, right? That's where they're fundamentally different identities to some extent.
But I think that you know, Samuel Huntington in that book, Who Are We, said that America is not simply a creedal nation. It's there's a, you know, Protestant like base to it.
Of course, its root. But in terms of forming along, if you're talking about what identity are we going to get integrated into, and obviously you can't entirely suppress that. But if that becomes, but the broader strategy is that it is partly suppressed because you're trying to include all sorts of people from such diverse groups, and you can't maintain your prime characteristic as a civic identity if you elevate, you know, some sort of you know, Protestant, some sort of, you know, radical Protestant kind of root of America.
But that's what it was until the 1960s when the you know, they introduced, as did Australia, effectively a non-discrimination immigration policy. And so it certainly existed as a nation with, for example, you know, with the Kennedys, Irish Kennedys eventually, you know, fighting in the Second World War and fighting in the Civil War and ingratiating themselves and eventually being accepted as Americans. So it's not, it wasn't impossible for those guys to become president. But I don't think that in George Washington's time they would have accepted a Catholic as president of the United States, right? It took quite a while.
But I mean, look, lots of things change around that time. And that's really, again, that's what's partly happening right across the world now. It's a backlash to what happened in the 60s, where you had a huge outpouring, all these old institutions crumble, you know, where it's religion, traditional family, traditional types of nationalism or cultural identity. All of those, to an extent, were weakened through the broad cultural uprising, if you like. That's what we mean by the different identity groups, you know, whether you're female, whether you're an ethnicity, whether you're disabled, whether you're gay. So all of those kind of were unleashed then. And part of what we're getting now is a backlash to the excesses of the last sort of, you know, 50, 60 years.
Yeah. And it can be done well and can be done very poorly. I mean, part of this NatCon stuff that I'm quite interested in, and the authors like Yoram Hazony and others that whose books I will recommend to anyone who fancies getting more into this, it's really critical of liberalism and modern liberalism, by which they mean the movement that has encouraged the breakdown of all unchosen restrictions, customary restrictions on individual, and exalted maximizing individual freedom against any previous restraints. And that's, you know, the Liberal Party in Australia at a recent function celebrated 80 years of liberalism, right? It's seen as their kind of creed. But I don't know. I feel like many on the center right don't appreciate that liberalism can also be a very destructive idea. And I also feel like liberalism, and this is be interested in your thing, is it actually good for the psychiatric health of individuals to be free from all constraints? Like, you know, don't they need to have things that hold them back and that they can latch onto, and otherwise they just run around like, you know, they're adults, but they run around effectively like children and aren't happy, as happy as they think they should be.
Look, absolutely, yeah. Freedom is, I can't remember which writer had that, you know, freedom is, you know, dangerous without strong limits and strong limitations and boundaries allow for a healthy freedoms. But, you know, even with identity, again, this is the big challenge with liberalism, that it sort of doesn't, like we're not, and it goes back to your very first question about identity, where we don't exist as pure individual citizens stripped of a ethno-cultural historical identity, right? But that's what that's what our system almost would like us to be at a very pure level, right? At a very pure level, but we're not. We do need to attach to groups. We are interested in ethno-cultural, you know, that's a very powerful force and it defines many of us to a strong degree. So there has to be room. So liberalism struggles with groups in general, how to foster groups, how to recognize groups. You know, so when you have all these debates like hate speech, etc., you know, a lot of that is trying to work out how do we identify and legally enshrine groups. You know, things like the voice referendum, you know, all of these things, you know, they're all about how do we deal with this, the notion of groups in a system that is centrally about individual citizens. And that is an ongoing challenge. And sometimes that is the problem when it's too, if you're too sterile about liberalism and individual citizenry, you just lack, you lack the drive, the impetus that group identity can really give. So that's where it is a real skill in modern nationhood. How do you build a sense of real patriotism, group identity to a national ideal? I guess to be honest, as me as an individual, I feel like I have been lucky. You know, talking about my Bangladeshi identity, you know, I was never, our family was never terribly religiously Muslim, but I'd be lying if I said I didn't identify with it at all. I do. But I feel like, you know, without, you know, I'm far from perfect, but I feel like I have a reasonable mix of being outwardly Australian, identifying as Australian, being proud of it, and having some sense of what Australian values are, its history, its ethno. Clearly, obviously, I'm not white Anglo-Saxon, but I can still attach to that. Yet, I'm not devoid of strong ties to my roots. I actually think that's really important, because I often see that even in my work, where you get people, you know, they might be of a certain background, and they have they don't understand that background, and outwardly they're very Australian, but if they haven't incorporated their past very well, that can be a problem. That can be a problem. There can be kind of gaps there, and they haven't really don't really have a fully integrated sense of who they are. So you do need
second generations who are often either anecdotally, but I'm sure it's right. You know, they either get really attached to want to be more like not Bangladeshi or whatever, more pro their parents' country than their parents were, or they go a bit wokey and they get very much into ultra liberalism and everything needs to be, there can't be any attachment to creed, color, or whatever traditional boundaries at all, right?
They can reject some aspect of their identity. And, you know, obviously this is stuff you're interested in as a psychiatrist, where, you know, it could be they hate their dad and their dad is the one from Afghanistan and their mother's from Iran or whatever it might be. And they're trying to detach themselves from one aspect of their identity, which may have deeper psychological roots. But in the longer term, that is usually problematic, you know. So, like, that needs to be integrated in some form. And people have a variety of ways of doing that, but rejecting critical parts, you know, it's the same goes with nations. You know, you'll have key parts of your history. That's why, it is silly pretending we're not, you know, rooted in British tradition. And yes, we have an Aboriginal past. And like you said, in America, that has a strong basis in a Protestant, Anglo-Saxon, Northern European kind of heritage. You know, that, the early founding fathers were very much rooted in that. So it's crazy to deny that. And so even the Korean American who is becoming American and is embracing that needs, you know, to be a good American, they need to understand that part of it and kind of accept that the roots of some of the roots of their civic American identity is rooted in a ethno-cultural one as well.
Yeah, I think I was reading somewhere that Thomas Aquinas said that people shouldn't be granted citizenship until of a country. This is the Middle Ages, Europe, obviously, until their third generation. So that's probably taking a little bit too far. But I kind of get a sense.
You can
see
where it comes from.
Yeah.
But, you know, go on.
Just to change tack slightly, but you know, talking psychiatry and clinical stuff, what do you think a psychiatrist of 100 years ago, transported to today, would notice most about people in our society?
Let's think about it. I mean, even thinking about a psychiatrist 100 years ago, I mean, most of them were in asylums, so they were, you know, treating the extremely unwell, and they were doing so essentially quite distant from the mainstream institutions, including mainstream healthcare. So they were very much in silos, treating people that were outside of society, effectively. They were virtually unseen. So this very unusual group, and psychiatry was very much a niche sort of discipline. We're still learning a great deal about it. Still had lots of overlaps with the occult and the religious and the superstitious. It was certainly changing. I mean, I guess how do we view human beings, say 100 odd years ago? It was very much rooted in place, ethno-cultural identity, religion. You know, that's how you were a Catholic or Protestant. You were a Brit. I mean, we weren't even straight. We would not have even seen ourselves as Australian 100 odd years ago.
Would they have looked around in the mall in Sydney and thought people are exhibiting like clinical conditions that they would have seen unusual to then in 1900? Do you think
much like that. I mean, it's more the level of individual expression would certainly be interesting, because it would have been much more, you know, back then you weren't expressing an individual identity so much. You know, very much you were part of clans, you were within a limited tribe, family, an identity very much rooted in that. And you weren't going, you know, now it's all about expressing who you are as an individual and having all these outer markers of that. And the consumer culture then overlaps with that. And obviously
taking antidepressants and stuff if you're not feeling, you know, super, super happy the whole time.
And even the notions of, I mean, even the notions of happiness. So, you know, one of the biggest change of the last 100 years at a philosophical or psychological level is a shift from a religious view of man to a therapeutic view of man.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is especially true in Western societies. So that's the biggest difference a psychiatrist might notice, that that even their ordinary patient was speaking the language of therapy. Right? Now that language didn't entirely exist. It was only really just kicking off 100-odd years ago.
Yeah, right.
Freud's ideas, etc., were kind of taking off, psychoanalysis. So prior to that, it was very much people had schizophrenia or dementia praecox. These were the names, and they were given tablets or whatever therapies there were. But the very notion now that we have a much more therapeutic idea of man, that we exist as personalities, we have feelings that need to be modified, we try and reach fulfillment in life, mm-hmm. and we do all sorts of, you know, things to do that. And even when we attach ourselves to groups, marriage, all of the things, whether it's marriage or work, it's life's project is about self-fulfillment. Whereas 100 years ago, life's project would have been about salvation primarily. It would have been about religion. Yeah, exactly. Duty, sacrifice. But if most people were outwardly religious, you know, their bigger life aim would have been some sort of salvation. And as part of that, there would have been, you know, a variety of values like duty, sacrifice, familial ties to God. So that's the most fundamental shift in how we view the human being, if you like. And that's the challenge of politics too, because, you know, people increasingly, to some extent, don't necessarily see, you know, we're very prosperous, our technology is extraordinary. So people don't always view the world of politics as potentially being of much significance in their life, because they see most of the tools of self-improvement, you know, being largely available to them.
And yet people seem to not be as happy as they once were. And, you know, women, despite their improvements, the stats I've seen say that they're, you know, more unhappy than they were in the 70s by many metrics. So it's hard to
absolutely all the mental health markers are different. I mean, look, there's lots of theories about that, and you know, one is, again, because we have a much bigger pressure to be fulfilled, that opens us up more to being unfulfilled. So expectations are much more different.
Mm-hmm.
Self-comparison is much greater than it's ever been. A meritocracy opens up much greater chance of failure. So in the past, you didn't have the same aspirations for mobility. You know, you just did what your dad did, and, you know, my dad's a carpenter, I'll be a carpenter. Whereas now there's a lot of aspiration, which can also mean a lot of disappointment.
Too many choices and your ability of bad choices. Yeah.
You can pretty much fashion, and going back to identity, the moment you're born, you're essentially being encouraged to fashion an individual identity. Almost stripped bare from historical context, if you like. So that's very different to, that's unique to the last half century or so, in a way.
And unique to the Western world.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, and relatively unique to the Western world. So, go on.
I'll finish with this question, Tavik, because I could talk to you all day, but I've dug up this old question I asked you last time. I think it's an interesting one. Like, imagine the entire Western world today could be reducible to a single individual medical patient. Let's call her Miss West. She's arrived at your surgery this morning. Reviewing her file, you see she used to be a very self-confident, outgoing girl, but recently this has changed. She's developed extreme anxiety. She's unhappy with herself and depressed. She engages in self-harm and unsocial behavior. You notice in discussions she increasingly seems to be losing her grip on reality as she's unable to distinguish between basic terms like man and woman. What would be your prognosis, a diagnosis for such an individual? What treatment options are available?
Look, I guess you're bringing up, individual patients do sometimes depict the culture. I mean, arguably the key individual patient now is almost the middle-aged, the person in their 30s, 40s, whose life isn't going quite to plan, and now they want a diagnosis of ADHD, right? So arguably that actually goes to the core of the modern culture, because it's so much about productivity. It's about rising in the meritocracy. It's about feeling like a failure because you haven't risen. It's about a chemical secular solution to fulfillment. It's about grabbing disability as a type of identity and to some extent excuse for when life doesn't always go your own way, but also secondary gain. You get a label, sometimes you get extra money, extra resources. So arguably a patient like that for me goes to the broader culture than the one you described. But that would overlap too. You have people, uncertain about gender, uncertain about gender relations, too focused on work identity as their site of fulfillment, struggling to find a spiritual, metaphysical purpose to life, then grappling onto all sorts of unusual new age type things. Conspiracy theories, that very much goes to modern online life, because you're detached from traditional groups, namely church, extended family. Because you're detached from those groups, you're more likely to tie onto the modern online ones, which can sometimes be linked to conspiratorial type thinking. So it's often these types of patients that give us a window into the modern culture, I would say, than the one you initially described. But that certainly overlaps too.
In some ways, it's a ridiculous question. You can't reduce the whole of Western civilization to a patient. And you certainly can't give Western civilization a pill and tell them to come back in the morning and it all will be well. It's a complex, multifactorial discussion about why we are where we are. Hey, Tamir, I appreciate you making time again to have a chat. There's heaps more to discuss, and maybe we'll check in again in a few more months or something and see where we're at. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah.
See ya. Bye.
Well, thanks, man.